Diplomatica, a journal of diplomacy and society.
If you walk into any history department in the United States and you ask someone, what is the paradigmatic case for event-based history, the answer you're likely to get will be, oh, diplomatic history. You know what diplomatic historians are like? They look at a peace settlement, they investigate the war, they find out who the players are, who negotiated for Team A, who negotiated for Team B, what were the issues at stake, how was it resolved, and they write up the article. That is why diplomatic historians are so boring. If you ask them to describe the most exciting work going on in history now, the answer you're likely to get is, oh, all the wonderful stuff that's gone on in social history. We have changed the way we think about the family, about gender, about sexuality. In fact, what we imagined for decades as transhistorical constants, that there was always a family, that there were always significant differences between men and women, that there was always a pattern of normative sexuality with certain modes of deviance. What we have learned is that none of those variables is transhistorical. Every single one of those has a complex history. The family in the 21st century does not look a thing like the family in the Middle Ages, and on and on and on and on and on. I was, as someone who's fascinated by politics, as someone who believes that political history is every bit as complicated and every bit as open to new modes of historiography, I was more than bothered by the stereotyping of my own field of interest, diplomatic history, as a frozen narration of events, a field that was doomed to a kind of synchronic narrative that could never be opened up to diachronic modes of investigation. So when I set out to write after Lavinia, I knew I had to write something that was transhistorical. I needed to find something in the history of diplomacy that looked like a constant, but on further investigation had a complicated, fascinating history. I turned to marriage. It was the obvious place to go. If you look at any book on the marriages of Henry VIII, if you look at a book on the early wars of Louis XIV, if you look at a book on the conversions of Europe in the early Middle Ages, what you're likely to find will be references to marriage settlements. And there is always the assumption of transhistoricity, that people in pre-modern Europe formed alliances through marriages. In fact, if you look at the Amarna papers, or the Amarna tablets, I guess we're talking about, the diplomatic correspondence between the ancient Babylonians and the Egyptians, one of the things that's talked about in that early correspondence is marriage. If anything seems to be transhistorical, it was that. I had found my subject. Now, the question of parameters inevitably comes up. Marriage is an enormous topic. How on earth can you tackle it in a limited space of one book? Marriage diplomacy is something that could be the subject of volumes. I started off by thinking, where could I find the quintessential pre-modern marriage? And I turned to the Cateau-Cambry Sea negotiations of 1559. The Peace of Cateau-Cambry Sea ended the decades-long war between the Valois and the Habsburgs with a pair of marriages. It also occasioned the first outpouring of printed volumes of poems on affairs of state in European literary history. This would be a perfect entry for me as someone who's always been interested in connections between political history and cultural history. So I spent a long time thinking about Cateau-Cambry Sea, what marriage meant, what ideals of peacemaking were embodied in the poetry as well as in the negotiations. And the book began to radiate out of Cateau-Cambrésis, going both to much earlier modes of peacemaking and moving forward to the French Enlightenment. What I discovered was that marriage diplomacy does indeed have a history. And it's an interesting history because at every single moment, political changes, changes in thinking about the ideology of marriage, about the value of this kind of peacemaking, ended up intersecting in creative and productive ways with the history of literary genre. So my earliest chapter deals with early Germanic ethnic histories, essentially ethnic histories of the Roman successor states, the Lombards, the Goths, the Anglo-Saxons. For those cultures, the primary significance of marriage was it offered a way of bringing two societies together and creating a new people. For Jordanus, the Gothic writer of the Gattica, the wonderful thing about marriage is that it eventually legitimizes his own Gothic peoples as a group, as a royal people, fully eligible for marriage into the Roman imperial line. As we move forward in the Middle Ages to the periods of the conversions, marriage diplomacy takes on a sacral character. Marrying the Christian the daughter of a Christian king to a non-Christian king becomes a way of making Christian society itself grow. That the history of Christianity becomes inseparable from the history of diplomacy, particularly in the Middle Ages, where so many diplomatic affairs were conducted by bishops and other churchmen. The real turning point for me was the Crusades. If marriage can create a new people, if marriage can foster the cause of Christendom, by the late Middle Ages, in the Crusades period, people are starting to think of marriage primarily as something that could lead to peace. That there was a premium placed on European peacemaking during the crusading period, because, of course, Europe needed to unite as a common army against its non-Christian enemies. Negotiators were looking for ways to strengthen alliances, new ways of creating them. And it is clearly in this period that the marriage of a royal daughter to a foreign king or the son of a foreign king becomes really regularized. And there is a remarkable idealization of peacemaking. It is precisely in this period that the women consorts who are married in diplomatic alliances are seen as types of the Virgin Mary uniting former enemies. And the burden of peacemaking will fall on these women. This leads then to what was my original chapter on Cateau-Cambrésis. But by the time I had come to Cateau-Cambrésis, after writing all these medieval materials, what was clear to me was that some of those ideals were starting to break down. And the second half of the book ends up taking a sad tone as the modern state begins to appear. You start seeing polities acting in ways that are no longer driven solely by dynastic logic. And this means that countries in negotiations with each other can no longer reconcile their differences through family means. Marriage diplomacy starts becoming quaint, starts becoming obsolete as you enter early modernity. It is no accident that only 20 years after Cateau-Cambrésis, the possibility of a marriage between Elizabeth I of England and a French prince will lead to an outpouring of pamphlets and poems urging her not to enter into that marriage. It's fascinating that some of these materials are in fact engaged in a close intertextual relationship with earlier French poetry celebrating such marriages. Finally, in the poetry, in the plays of William Shakespeare, again and again and again, diplomatic marriages appear as betrayals of fundamental English interests. The world was changing, and I don't want to leave the impression that the earlier mode of peacemaking was necessarily effective. It wasn't. Many of the women who went to foreign courts as peace weavers found themselves hated by political factions who did not want the alliance to work. Sometimes a royal marriage could create problems down the line. The Hundred Years' War famously results from an earlier marriage alliance between France and England that ended up confusing the succession to the French crown. Many such negotiations failed. And yet, pre-modernity, because of this long practice of marriage diplomacy, was able to do at least two things that modern affairs of state often failed to do. One, it provided a cultural role for women as often as diplomats, as women who could have an active role in bringing countries together. Again, it's an ideal. It wasn't always there in practice. But by the time you have the modern state, until the 20th century, women are not part of the direct negotiations in a way they were in prior times. Finally, the early culture of marriage diplomacy had a way of talking about national feelings. Emotion was something recognized and given a place at the diplomatic table. The language for polities to discuss alliances was a language of love and affection. Nowadays, of course, we think of diplomacy as a fully rational business. And yet, I remember during the Gulf War, when I was writing this book, again and again and again on the U.S. News, the question came up, and I quote, "Why do they hate us?" We live in a world where conflicts arise not simply because of differences in interests, but because of differences in feelings. Long-standing hatreds need to be addressed diplomatically. I do have the question of whether or not we can negotiate states of feeling using the rational language of diplomacy that is an inheritance of the Enlightenment. Thanks.